Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 22, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Our call today focuses on immigration law and policy. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We'll hear opening remarks from each, hearing first from former Congressman, the Honorable Thomas G. Tancredo, who's now co-chairman of Team America PAC and president of Rocky Mountain Foundation. He'll be followed in his opening remarks by the Honorable Linda Chavez. She's chairman of the Center for Equal Opportunity. We're very pleased to welcome both of them. I mentioned we'll have opening remarks and then a little bit of back and forth between the two of them. But as always, we'll be turning to our audience for your questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Congressman Tancredo, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be talking about this subject, which I consider to be one of the most important public policy discussions we can have. For a variety of reasons that I'm sure we'll get into. But just a brief look at our immigration policy from a historical perspective. Immigration into this country was quite a cyclical sort of event up until about 1965. Prior to that, we had, around the turn of the century, of course, in the early part of, in the late part of the 1900s, we had a massive increase in the number of immigrants coming, and then shortly thereafter, it decreased pretty dramatically, and it did this for a couple of decades, sort of up and down. And it was a reflection mostly of the issue of jobs and what was available in the United States at the time. There were the periods of low immigration were when we had, for instance, a lot of returning soldiers and who people believed needed jobs, and so there were even massive deportations at that time, during those times, of people who were here illegally. 1965, Teddy Kennedy wrote a bill that changed everything in terms of immigration policy, especially changed the nature of immigration and the basis of immigration, and it changed it away from what was attempting to be sort of an employer-based or a needs-based immigration policy in terms of, you know, the kind of resources, a kind of skills and capabilities that we needed, to something that we now call family unification. Family unification is, by and large, the greatest part of immigration into the country and has been now for a long, long time. In terms of how many people we bring into the country legally, again, there's some, I guess, misunderstanding about this, because I often hear from people that, you know, we just need to be less restrictive about legal immigration, but indeed we bring in more people every single year legally than any other country in the world, a little over a million one. Interestingly, about less than 8% of that total number are actually employer-sponsored. The rest, again, are from this grouping called family unification. Now, the impact of massive immigration, both legal and illegal, is something, of course, that we are going to be discussing, and we will have, I'm sure, that Linda and I have different viewpoints on the impact. I see it as negative, by and large, not entirely, but certainly negative from an economic standpoint and from what I would say is a cultural standpoint. Now, what I mean by that is that although the, and because of this family unification category being the largest, we recognize that most of the people coming are coming with very low skills and commanding very low wages. And so the commensurate social services that need to be provided for the folks that are coming, both educational and roads, housing, health care, and all the rest. These costs are rising pretty dramatically, and the amount of positive impact on the GDP is overwhelmed by the costs we incur for this kind of immigration. We are not bringing people in here who are contributing greatly to the overall health of the economy, although there is a positive economic impact to the GDP. The bulk of that goes to the people who actually are coming, the immigrants, and not to the people who are here, and certainly not to the low-wage workers who are American citizens or even immigrants awaiting citizenship, but who have come here legally. The cultural impact. Now, this is the more controversial aspect of it, because the minute you say, use even the word culture to interject that into a discussion of immigration, the epithets start flowing. And usually they are like, they are mostly things like racist, xenophobe, nativist, and all the rest of that. That cyclical period that I talked about of immigration, it worked well for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it allowed a degree of assimilation to occur during the low periods of the low sides of the cycle. And of course, we haven't had that again. We have not had the slightest reduction of immigration since 1965. And we have what I also refer to as the cult of multiculturalism that permeates our society from in the education arena, and certainly the media. And this, what this is a philosophy that demeans, the American history that I guess I learned when I was in school, and it really doesn't like the idea that people would actually assimilate. In fact, the word has essentially been banned from the literature on the left and the people who are what I would call open borders. Progressives. They don't like the word. They don't want assimilation because it connotes some degree of that somebody has to give up something in order to actually be successful here. But I think that that's right. You probably do. And one of the things that one should surrender is the adherence to another language other than English. This nation has so many things. Because we are so diverse, it has so many things that separate us. We don't have common, for the most part. We're not all from one place or reflective of one culture or with the same attitudes, ideas, religions, and or languages. We desperately need something that holds us together as a nation. And I think one of those things is the language. It's also a desire, I think, on the part of people who come here as immigrants to actually become Americans, both not just on paper, but in their heart of hearts. That's a little more subjective in terms of how we define that, I'm sure. But when we teach our own, people who are not immigrants, but certainly we teach our children in our schools that there's nothing of value here in the United States, and our history is not one to be emulated by anybody else. Then you can understand why nobody really gets excited about connecting to it. So that's our side of the problem. That's this cult of multiculturalism. But when you combine it with massive immigration of people who are not necessarily looking to assimilate, you can see that difficulties arise. So It's got nothing to do, from my point of view, by the way, it has absolutely nothing to do with race or ethnicity. Immigration is tied to economics and geography solely. And I say all the time, you know, I'm Italian by background, and I would tell you that if Italy were on our southern border and had the same economic problems as does Mexico, we'd see the same exact patterns flow out of Mexico into Italy, southern Italy, to the United States. It's not an issue of race or ethnicity. And we're looking at countries all over the world that are now beginning to deal with this problem, recognizing that their lenient immigration policies and this multiculturalist influence in their countries, England, France, the Netherlands, Italy, all of these countries are now looking at ways to change the pattern because it has been so destructive. We have been looking, some of us have been looking at ways to change that pattern for a long time, but there are major obstacles to the kind of reform I'd like to see, which I will certainly explain. I would first of all reduce immigration based on family unification and replace it with some system that's more reflective of our needs. I would certainly secure the borders. But in order to get there, you have to overcome two huge obstacles. One is the Democrat Party that looks at massive immigration, both legal and illegal, as a source of potential voters. The other is the Republican Party that looks at that same phenomena and sees massive numbers of low-wage workers, cheap labor. And so that combination has made it impossible to move ahead on the kind of reform that I seek anyway. And the status quo actually ends up benefiting both sides. If you can't move in either direction, if you can't increase the numbers or decrease them, they'll accept the status quo because it serves both interests. It serves the interests of the Democrat elite and the Republican elite. So that's why we haven't moved anywhere. I believe that we need to employ something called E-Verify. I think we need to enforce E-Verify. That would be a major, major step in the right direction. E-Verify is, of course, a program now that can be used by anybody or any employer. It's available. But only employers that access it are those that know that their employees are probably all legal. You just go online and put in a social security number and determine whether that's a good number. It doesn't tell you that the employee is an illegal alien. It just says the number is good or it is not. And then you say, you know, you have to fix this. I don't know what's wrong with it. But when you get correct number, come back to us and we can work with you. So enforcing E-Verify would be a major step in the right direction. Securing the borders would be the other, and reducing immigration and changing the policy away from family unification to something that's more reflective of our needs is what we need.
Linda Chavez, your opening remarks?
Great. Thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to be on a forum with Tom Tancredo. We are old friends, and listening to Tom, there is a great deal with which I agree in what he has said. First of all, I think, you know, all of us in this age of terrorist threats are interested in a secure border. It is not to our advantage to have a porous border in which people can cross over willy-nilly without being intercepted. But the question is how best to secure that border. We already spend more on criminal border enforcement than we do on all other federally combined criminal law enforcement. We spent in 2014 $16.2 billion. On the non-border enforcement areas, which includes the Marshal Service, Drug Enforcement, Secret Service, ATF, et cetera, we spent about $1 billion less than that. So we are spending a lot of money on border security. And the question is, how is that money being directed? I would like it to see it being directed at intercepting drug traffickers, human traffickers, and potential terrorists. And I would like to give those people who are coming here to work as landscapers or nannies or construction workers an opportunity to do so legally. I agree with Tom that our current system, while we do take in about 1 million people, I would suggest that the fact that about 5% of our labor force is made up of people who are in the country illegally suggests that that 1 million is not sufficient to meet our labor needs. And so the question is, how do we come up with a policy that suits our needs as a country? I think the idea of family reunification may sound humane. It may have sounded good in the 1960s, but it certainly should not be the driver of immigration policy today. We should be looking to admit people who are going to benefit this nation. Where I disagree with Tom is that there's no question that we have labor needs, and we have labor needs at two ends of the skilled spectrum. We need STEM workers, so science, technology, engineering, and based permits to allow people to come and work in those fields. We train people here as engineers, et cetera, and then we make them go home because they're not allowed to get a permanent resident visa. So we need those workers. But we also have a need for workers at the low end of the skill spectrum. And here's where the big disagreement with Tom is. We do, in fact, need workers to do jobs that Americans either are too well trained to do or simply will not take. And the idea that we can simply raise wages in fields like picking tomatoes or processing meat and poultry or janitorial services, that if we simply paid $15 or $20 or $25 an hour, that we could find American workers to do those jobs is simply not borne out by the reality. And I speak as somebody who has served on the corporate boards of major corporations involved in those fields, including for a number of years the largest chicken processing and chicken producing company in the United States at the time, Pilgrim's Pride. So, you know, one of the problems is that Americans are well educated. We spend a lot of money educating the American born, and many of these jobs do not require that kind of education. And the work is difficult. It's dangerous. It's unpleasant. And finding Americans who are willing to stand on a poultry processing line, I can speak from experience, is quite difficult. Tom mentioned E-Verify. When I was working on the board of directors at Pilgrim's Pride, we had a very large raid by ICE. We were one of the first national employers to use E-Verify at all of our locations. But when ICE came in, they were able to find some 300 to 400 people working in our plants illegally. So E-Verify is not a panacea to ensure that people are not here illegally. As Tom suggested, all that E-Verify can do is validate that the person is giving a Social Security number that is a valid number. And in fact, I would argue that some of the identity fraud and the manipulation of data that we've seen that has grown out of illegal immigration has been an industry that's been fueled. The harder we make it for people to get jobs and have to show identifications, the more opportunities we give to the unscrupulous and the criminals to come up with ways to allow workers to do that. So my alternative would be to work toward a system that was, in fact, focused on our economic needs, to make it a skills-based system, but recognizing that we have needs at both the low and the high end of the skill set. I would make it market-driven. We would admit more people during times of low unemployment than we would during periods such as we've experienced over the last several years. And in fact, the illegal immigrant market is, in fact, very market-driven. We've seen a large drop in the number of illegal immigrants living in the United States as we've gone through a recession. But I also want to take just a couple of minutes to address some of Tom's concern on the cultural front, because I really do believe that the cultural argument is an important one, and it's also one that has been driving the immigration debate. Those who are concerned about the flow of primarily Hispanic immigrants and to a less extent Asian immigrants, and those are the two large bulks of people that we are admitting under the family-based system that we have in place now, they're worried that Hispanics in particular are not, in fact, assimilating. But if you look at the data, that just does not seem to be the case. Hispanics are rapidly learning English. They are learning English faster than the generation of immigrants who came when Tom's ancestors came in the early part of the 20th century. They are continuing their education. By the second generation, we have virtually closed the gap between high school graduation rates for native-born and second-generation Hispanics. And over the last 2 years, we've actually had a higher proportion of high school grads who are Hispanic going on to further their education than we have among non-Hispanic whites. English has become the preferred language of Hispanics of the third generation and higher. And one study which looked at the whole question of whether or not English should be the official language discovered that among third generation Hispanics, over two-thirds believe that English ought to be the official language of the United States. And that figure, by the way, compares quite favorably to whites, where the percentage was about 74%. So we are not becoming a nation, despite all of the attempts of the left, all of the attempts of the multiculturalists to try to balkanize us, to try to promote teaching in Spanish for immigrant children and even non-immigrant children who happen to have a Spanish surname. Those attempts do not seem to be succeeding very well. In terms of the question of whether or not these immigrants are contributing, I will say just one other thing, and that is that whenever you look at the cost, the social cost of the children of immigrants or immigrant children themselves, the biggest driver of cost is education. But education is not just a cost, it is also an investment. And those studies that take a look at the earnings of those children who've been educated in American schools and look at the earnings when they are adults find that there is, in fact, a net positive contribution. And that applies equally to those who come from more low-skilled backgrounds, Mexican immigrants and other Hispanics. They are net contributors. They also do pay taxes, as do a substantial number of those who are in the country illegally. About two-thirds of them are paying into the Social Security system, and virtually all immigrants, even those who are in the country illegally, pay property taxes, which is, in fact, what funds schools in most states. If you're a renter, part of your rent is going to pay property taxes. It's not the landlord that's paying the taxes. He's simply the tax collector for the government and passes that on through. So I would argue that if we're concerned about assimilation, which I am, I've made my career promoting the idea of assimilation. I don't think we have anything to fear from the newest crop of immigrants who virtually all studies suggest are assimilating not just as fast, but faster. They're intermarrying at rates much higher than previous generations, and they're catching up much faster in education. I will just remind Tom that when I was at the Civil Rights Commission during the Reagan administration, we commissioned a study on Southern and Eastern Europeans and took a look at their ultimate integration into American society. It took the great bulk of Italian immigrants who came at the beginning of the 20th century until 1970 to catch up in average education levels with other Americans. That was 50 years, more than 50 years after the peak immigration period. So the generation of immigrants that are coming now, I think, are integrating. I think they are moving into the mainstream. And moreover, I think that our economy desperately needs these workers if we are to grow. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you both. I want to give Congressman Tim Crato a chance to respond and then hear more from Linda Chavez. But before we do that, let me let people get in the queue to ask questions in a moment. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you're in the audience after you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to you momentarily. But before we do that, Congressman, you want to take a minute or two to augment your statement or respond to Linda Chavez?
Sure. Well, as is often the case in any debates of this nature that I've participated in, it comes down to dueling statistics and dueling studies, because for almost every single study that Linda mentioned, there is one that contradicts her analysis. Let's look at 1997 study by the National Academy of Sciences. The panel of demographers and economists detailed how the immigration fuels U.S. population growth and the fiscal costs and the negative social policy that comes as a result of this large-scale immigration. And the result is that although they identified, as I mentioned, an increase in economic benefit from about somewhere between $1 billion and $10 billion. That's a pretty wide variance, but it is indeed outweighed by the cost to the American taxpayer in budget analysis. So when you bring in a lot of folks who are low-skilled, low-wage workers, the fact is that what we have to do as a society to provide for them, just their existence here in terms of health care, in terms of education, in terms of housing, roads, all the rest, you recognize that because they are primarily low-skilled, low-wage workers, they do not pay very much, if of anything, in terms of income tax. Yes, they pay into property taxes directly or indirectly through renting. Yes, they pay sales taxes when they purchase something, but it does not, according to many, many studies, and the one I mentioned is a premier study, it doesn't pay the freight for them. And so that's one thing. There's another thing about this cultural assimilation. Studies I have seen would indicate that indeed we are not seeing that kind of rapid movement into American society and relinquishment of both language and the kind of maybe emotional attachments, even political attachments that one feels to the mother country. Some of this is a result of the fact that the country contributing so many people into this pool of folks we call illegal immigrants is on our border. And where in times past, when people came, as they did from certainly Italy and all over Europe, there was not the ability to communicate easily. You could not go back and forth easily. And so the assimilation process was forced upon them, or people returned. As, by the way, I think more Italians returned to Italy because they chose, for whatever reason, to go back than any other group during that period of high immigration into this country. So, again, I know there's this attempt to kind of identify the problem as sort of ethnic But it is not. It's got nothing to do with that. It is a problem, as I say, of geography and economics. E-Verify, when I say enforce E-Verify, I'm talking about an enforcement process that includes the Social Security Administration, so that indeed you have to have that administration working just as hard as Homeland Security in the effort to actually enforce E-Verify. Without it, it is a failure, and I certainly agree with Linda on that. One last thing. When we talk about the need for the especially agricultural workers in the United States, and since we have so many people who are here illegally, it must be reflective of that need. Remember this, and again, it's something not too many people are aware of, but H-2A, that's the visa that allows people to come into this country primarily for agricultural purposes, you know, to pick crops, okay? There are no limits on H-2A visas, none. You could bring in 10 million people legally into this country for that purpose. But there are requirements that make it more difficult, of course, because you have to pay minimum wage, you have to provide some sort of housing, you have to provide health care, and even transportation. So it's a pretty expensive undertaking. And so as long as you have a massive number of people who are indeed available without those encumbrances, you're going to seek them. Only 60,000 people are here with that kind of visa, although we're told that we need millions for that purpose. And that's why we need, and that's again, a reflection of all these people who are here legally. It's got to be a demands issue. Well, there may very well be a demand for the labor, but if you have a choice between actually having to bring them in legally with the kind of restrictions I just mentioned, or, you know, going down to your local Home Depot parking lot and picking up as many as you want for a lot less money, you can understand why there's the allure.
Wendy Chavez.
Well, let me pick up that last point because I think it's actually an excellent one. Tom is absolutely right. There are no limits on the number of H-2A visas available. And he's right in terms of what an employer has to go through, the hoops that an employer has to go through in order to get that visa. First of all, you have to show that you've offered the job to an American and you can't find an American to work. Now, if you've got peaches ripening on the trees and you have to put out a notice and you have to wait to see if any Americans show up, those peaches are going to be overripe by the time you get to the process where you can get those workers. Then, as Tom suggested, you have to provide them transportation, health care, and housing, and if not minimum wage, you have to provide them. You have to provide them prevailing wages. I find it fascinating that my fellow conservatives think that these ought to be the duties of an employer, and I suggest that if all employers had to do that, we'd have to go back to the old company town kind of hierarchy where we had a kind of patriarch who was not only our employer but took care of us. So I think that's that point really makes the case that I've tried to make, which is that we ought to treat these jobs like we do all other jobs. There ought to be competition. And the fact is, Americans won't do those jobs, and perhaps they shouldn't be doing those jobs. You know, the average American has about 13 and a half years of education. I guess, you know, we've spent a great deal of money educating that person. We probably shouldn't want them picking peaches on the western slope of Colorado after investing that kind of money. But it is a job that still needs to be done, and we do have the choice. We could ship these jobs overseas. We could grow our peaches elsewhere. We already import a good deal of our fruits and vegetables. We could import 100% of it, I suppose. There are other jobs in construction and some of the other service industries that we can't export. We can't take those jobs and simply ship them overseas. But even if we were able to do so, this would not have a positive impact on our economy. It would have a negative one. If we could wave a magic wand tomorrow and 11 0.2 million illegal immigrants would disappear. It would be about the same effect on our economy as a major disaster in an American city, wiping out a part of our GDP. So in terms of the cultural issue and in terms of the cost of these immigrants, I'm very familiar with the National Academy of Science Studies, and what it did show was that there was net positive flow of taxes to the federal government from immigrants, and the cost was at state and local governments. But again, this was looking at the immigrant generation, and once you take into account, as the NAS did in one of its chapters, the contribution made by the children of immigrants, those who are actually born here, those costs begin to be mitigated. So I don't think we have to fear that we are going to be overwhelmed. I do not believe that our country would benefit from shrinking. I think people are not a problem. I think people are the great advantage we have, and I would like to see more people coming to the United States, albeit I'd like to see them come legally, but I'd like them to give them the opportunity to do so by making an immigration policy that makes sense for all of us.
Well, thank you both. A couple of good rounds of opening remarks there. Before we turn to the audience, and we do have three questions pending, let me just make our typical commercial announcement. First, generally speaking, this is the season of busyness for the Supreme Court. They're handing down a lot of decisions on decision days. The next decision day is Tuesday. We've reserved Tuesday for a possible courthouse steps edition of Teleforum. So do check the Federalist Society's website and monitor your emails for Teleforum conference calls that might be scheduled sort of on the fly. Next week, already scheduled, we do have a call on a new book by Jonathan Rauch. The book is Political Realism: How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. And that's next Wednesday. Today, of course, we're talking about immigration law and policy. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take the first call of the day here.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Casey. I'm calling from Austin. And I think that there's a preliminary question that needs to be addressed. I haven't heard either speaker do it, but I think for your time, on what does it mean to be a citizen? Because the way we've defined immigration, it seems, is we've retreated to a pre-United States version of what it means to belong to a country, to have a relationship with a country. Our founders divorced themselves legally from the notion of citizenship based on the soil to a citizenship based on consent. And if, you know, prior to that, if you were born in France, you were always a Frenchman no matter where you live. And so when if we address that initially and realize that it's based on consent, I think a lot of the glaring policy errors that we've done since then come to light, and I like to address both parties. With the Democrat Party, it's the welfare state, which has created that huge draw since 1965. It's the minimum wage, which free market economics would say very completely that you're killing all of your unskilled workers by having a minimum wage and actually creating unemployment. And it's the progressive income tax, which does, a lot of it gets escaped. And if we had a sales tax, the amount of money to the federal government and the economy of scale would benefit us, because the more immigration you had, all of that revenue would be captured, and you wouldn't have to change your tax rate because you have more taxpayers because they buy more products. With respect to the Republican Party, their tough on crime stance is killing this, because at common law, there is no crime of illegal immigration. It's a regulatory offense, just like breaking a stoplight or running a corner, right on red. And lastly, the war on terror, I think that's confused this, because we want to have safe borders, but we've confused safe borders with the idea of I don't want like a single point of entry to protect against communicable diseases and national defense. And so I'd like to see if y'all would address those problems from the position of citizenship by consent rather than what it seems that y'all are presupposing as citizenship based on the soil.
Who wants to respond
first? I'll go ahead and start. First of all, obviously, if you were not born here and if you're going to become a citizen, it has to be through consent. One of my concerns about some of the proposals out there floating for changing immigration policy is that there is a lot of eagerness, certainly in the business community, to move to a large guest worker program similar to what we had during the 1950s and in early 60s with the Bracero program, which, by the way, did, in fact, virtually eliminate illegal immigration at that time. We had illegal immigration rates in that period that were twice as high as the highest rate, which was 1995 to 2000 in the recent era. My problem with that is that I don't want a society that is two-tiered in which we have a large group of people who do not identify as Americans, who do not want to speak the common language and do not want to consider themselves as American citizens. So I am much more in favor of having people admitted as permanent residents and having a generous immigration policy that takes in large numbers of people on a permanent basis with an avenue toward citizenship. In terms of the whole notion of the draw of welfare programs for non-U.S. born, I mean, again, the studies show that while these folks are poor in bulk, poorer than the native-born, their use of welfare programs is actually lower than the use of the native-born. That's especially true in the Medicare program, and they're actually net contributors to the tune of about $10 billion. That's $10 billion with a B a year in terms of the amount of taxes they pay and the benefits that are taken out. Again, some of the other proposals the gentleman offered, from a flat tax or a national sales tax, I'm all in favor of that, not just because we'd get more taxes from people who were here and not born here or came here illegally, but because I think it's a more sensible and fairer system overall.
Well, I agree with that completely in terms of changing the tax structure and for a lot of reasons. And I also agree with Linda about the nature of citizenship. That's in a way, I think that's what we were arguing in terms of what does it mean in America? Because, as I said, we have a nation that is so diverse in many ways, we need something that connects us all. And when we recognize that that can't be simply the fact that you are present in this particular area, you are on this soil, so therefore you are somehow a citizen. No, it's got to mean a lot more than that. And that gets into this whole issue of multiculturalism and whether we encourage that in our school systems, which we used to encourage the concept of citizenship, meaning that you're commitment was to the country, was certainly, if you could identify any one thing, I guess, that we should be able to all agree upon, it is the importance of the Constitution to this republic and to our way of governing ourselves. And so that's sort of number one. And, you know, it's a difficult thing because it's not easily quantifiable in terms of exactly, you know, how much a person has assimilated and how much they haven't. You just, you know, when you see massive demonstrations of people demanding citizenship or demanding simply to be allowed to live here and without the stigma of being here illegally, just simply, I want to come, I want to be here, I want to work, that's all I want. In fact, many of the people who are here illegally do not want to be citizens. They have no intention, no extreme desire to move in that direction. They want the other benefits that are available here. And the, you know, I know there is a sort of a libertarian attitude about what borders should mean or their relevance, their importance. And, you know, the idea that markets shouldn't be the determining factor as to the movement of goods, services, and people. But even Milton Friedman agreed with the fact that that doesn't work when you have the kind of welfare state that we have developed, and certainly that they have developed throughout Western Europe, there are major problems with that concept. And we, I think we have to recognize them when we talk about an immigration policy, and that's why when you say it, we both have said that it's got to be based on our needs. Well, you know, indeed, what are our needs? Do we truly need millions of people coming into the country, pursuing those jobs in that are the lowest paid on the rung and that don't require any individual, any kind of skill level beyond that? Is that really the need? If it isn't, how do you shift that away from what we're doing? And also even the STEM areas where that Linda says we have such a great need. Indeed, other studies dispute that. There was one in the Atlantic Monthly, I think it was last year, Science and Engineering Shortage is a Myth. And it went on to describe the fact that although there is this common misunderstanding out there about the need for greater immigration in this area, indeed, there's nothing that suggests that we're not creating enough in our colleges, enough people. We aren't providing enough to the marketplace from our colleges and universities of people who have these particular skills. So with, as I said, though, in this area, I assure you that for every single study that I can produce or Linda can produce, there is one that conflicts with that. It's been going, and this debate has been going on a long time, a lot of research into both sides, and so you can get both sides to support your position, I guarantee you that.
Well, we're sparking some interest here in the audience. We've got five questions pending now in about 12 minutes, so might have to pick up the pace, and I'm going to ask the audience members to be as concise as possible with their questions. Let's go to our next audience member.
Thanks very much. This is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. I work for Linda, so I should announce that in
well, this isn't fair.
But actually, I wanted to ask her if she could elaborate a little bit, and Tom, I'd like you to, you know, respond as well on the issue of education. I think I heard you, Linda, saying that the percentage of Hispanics now going to college is higher than the percentage of non-Hispanic whites. Is that right?
There is a higher proportion of high school graduates who are Hispanics for the last 2 years that have been going on to pursue higher education. Many of them, the great bulk of them, are going to two-year colleges. There is about a 10% differential in terms of high school graduation rate. So 10% fewer Hispanics graduate high school, second-generation Hispanics graduate high school than non-Hispanic whites. So there's still some slight differential in graduation from high school, but they are more likely then to go on to higher education.
Well, if you could just, you know, continue to, you know, elaborate on that theme. It's very timely because I'm actually going to be testifying before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights next week on, and the focus of the hearings is on, you know, what they believe to be disparities for minorities in access to college. And Tom is right that, you know, a lot of this, you know, becomes a war of statistics, and you have to be very careful because, you know, different racial and ethnic groups are different ages. You know, some groups have a higher percentage of younger people than others, and you have
right. The
point that you made, Linda, that, of course, just because you go to college doesn't mean that you graduate from college, and not all colleges are, you know, four-year colleges. You also have, you know, two-year colleges, but of course, if you can transfer from a two-year college to a four-year college, and the fact that you start out at a two-year college doesn't really mean anything that, you know, that you don't have the potential to go on. So, if I could ask you both just to talk a little bit more about education, so that I'll know what to say next week.
Well, we may have to have a private conversation on that, Roger, because we got a whole line of people waiting that way.
I'm all for education of anybody here, of any ethnic background, of any persuasion, as long as it is in English.
All right, let's take another question. We can return to that if you would like to, either of our experts.
Hello, this is Matt Muggeridge, and I am an immigration attorney. And so I don't know where my interests are in liberalization or in ever-increasing number of regulations and laws, because they're both good for business. But
right.
My question is, first of all, what is the what does the literature say about the aftermath of the so-called Reagan amnesty? And secondly, the situation as it is now, regardless of the policy implications and the political consequences, it often seems to me, going to immigration court and speaking with clients many times a week, just the sheer unenforceability of the law as it stands, with all of the constitutional protections that everyone in deportation proceeding has, every single one of them. I mean, an immigration lawyer can jam up a system virtually indefinitely if they haven't had a prior deportation. So my question is, are there good indications of the, it's been long enough time has passed from the Reagan amnesty, in terms of economic and social integration, et cetera. And secondly, does anyone care that this is just a totally intractable problem?
Okay. Well, go ahead. You want to start, Tom?
Okay. Again, I'm sure that Linda and I will have a different view on what happened subsequent to the Reagan amnesty. But what I recall is that what was supposed to be an amnesty for a relatively few number of people here, maybe a million or so, turned out to be something far greater than that. What was supposed to be a process that would make sure that the people who were achieving that amnesty did not have any sort of prior legal problems, that they indeed were quote, upstanding individuals who could make good citizens. The reality is by the end of the process, it became nothing more than a rubber stamp process, and that hundreds of thousands of people were given amnesty who indeed had criminal records, criminal backgrounds. Now, that could be, that could be simply a problem that's endemic to a bureaucracy. It could also be because that was kind of maybe a where the folks who were pushing this inside the immigration community wanted to go, and they didn't like the restriction that was on there to begin with. But for whatever reason, we saw that there was this breakdown in the processing. I think President Reagan later referred to it as one of the biggest mistakes he had ever made. And I certainly tend to agree with him that it was. We had all kinds of promises that were being made by both the business community and the political class about what would happen if we could just do this one thing, if we could just have this amnesty and, get this through the system, that from that point on we were going to get, number one, cooperation from Mexico on securing the border, that we would get cooperation from the Chamber of Commerce and business community on making sure that people who were being hired actually had legal status in the country. None of these promises were fulfilled. So, in fact, it was a big mistake.
Well,
and in terms of the bureaucracy that we presently have, you are absolutely right. It is, if you look at any chart that identifies, that tries to identify what our immigration policy is, it is absolutely impossible to decipher. It is a bureaucratic nightmare. And to the extent that we can do something about that, including, by the way, making those H-2A visas a lot more accessible to employers, I'm all for it.
Well, I absolutely agree that it was a disaster, but I would point to the fact that what was a disaster about the amnesty was, and it was a true amnesty, by the way, in a way that neither the Bush proposed legislation or the Gang of Eight compromise that put forward was an amnesty. Both of those proposals had fines that individuals who violated the law would have to pay and would have to also show that they paid back taxes. But the problem with the 1986 law, which gave amnesty to between 3 and 4 million people, was that it was coupled with changes in immigration law that basically turned every employer in America, and really every person who hires somebody even once a week to clean their house, into adjuncts of the Border Patrol. If you are an employer and you have a regular babysitter, you have somebody who comes and does gardening work, or you have somebody who works part-time doing handyman work for you, you are, by law, by the Immigration Reform and Control Act, required to fill out what's called an I-9 form. You're supposed to check that person's right to work in the United States, and it doesn't matter if that person's name is Linda Chavez or Tom Tancredo or John Smith. Every single person who is hired is supposed to show identity papers that show that they have a legal right to work in the United States. It is an unenforceable law, and what it essentially did is, without fixing the system by which we could have a market-based immigration policy, it put in place bureaucrats who determined the number of people that we need each year without taking into account what the economic conditions are or what employer needs are. So I think it was a disaster, and I do think that it can be fixed, but it can only be fixed with a policy that puts U.S. interests first, is skills-based, and is market-based.
We've got just a couple minutes left. Let me try and get these next two questions on the table very quickly, and then we'll let each of our guests take a shot at their favorite question. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, my name is Marge Adelsberger, and I'm here in Woodrow, Pennsylvania. I just wonder, we know nothing about the people that are coming here illegal. We don't know their background. We don't know their criminal status. We don't know their disease status. And Ms. Chavez is saying that they want to assimilate and learn English. We have commissioners here or councilmen here in the Philadelphia area that want to change the official language of the United States to Spanish. And there are people that have been here for years. And I don't see any assimilation at all in our neighborhood. And when Tom says they make demands on people in the United States, that we resent it. When you have people up there saying, we want to be citizens and we're here illegally and we sit in your streets, it makes you resentful. I'm sorry, I'm all fired up, but I can't see it. I think it's destroying America. And I think the people that are for it are just people that I don't know what you want to do, but I think you're trying to destroy America. Thank you.
Let's see if we got another question here really quickly. Go ahead,
Hello?
Caller. Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a few ideas I think most Americans could get behind, and if you agree generally, why hasn't it been done? And it is to make immigration policy on the basis of what is best for America, allow time for assimilation, close the border actually, de facto, not just in theory, and go after people who overstay their visas, limit family reunification, bring up again the Bracero program, and even have a domestic one if that might work for able-bodied Americans. Cutting welfare for those people might encourage them to work. That's it. Those are just a few thoughts I think most people could support. And I'm not against people coming into the country. It's a matter of how many can come in and be assimilated without changing the American culture to something that is undesirable, at least from the standpoint of those of us who have lived here for a lifetime and think it's great and encourage others to come.
Well,
let me give each of our guests just 60 seconds, if we could, to, just to wrap up and respond to either one of those last two comments. Let me
respond to both in terms of the cultural arguments. The very same arguments that are being made today about Mexicans and Salvadorans, et cetera, changing the culture were made in the early 1900s about Jews and Italians and Greeks and Poles and others that were coming. They were made in the middle of the 19th century about the Germans and Scandinavian immigrants were coming. And in fact, those groups did assimilate. There is no question that Hispanics are assimilating. 90% of all second generation Hispanics speak English very well, and it is the preferred language where they use at work, what they use to get their news from, and as I said, two-thirds of third-generation Hispanics support English as the official national language of the United States. English is important. It has been the great assimilator. It has allowed us to be a nation of immigrants and accommodate people from all parts of the world, but there is no indication whatsoever that Hispanics are making a change in terms of English as the dominant language in the U.S. or that they are not learning English. They are.
Oh, my. Well, of course, there are studies that prove just the opposite and show that third-generation Hispanics in this country do not, Mexicans, I should say, as because that was the focus of the study, still do not consider themselves Americans. They still identify themselves as Mexicans first. This assimilation process that Linda assumes is not happening. It is, and it's observable. It's not something that is all that theoretical in nature in terms of how we can decide whether or not which of us, I guess, is accurate. Or the go to Miami, go to Brownsville, Texas, go to almost any city on the border, and tell me that English is the dominant language. It is not, and that is one of the most important aspects of assimilation. It is the willingness to accept that. And as terms of immigration patterns of the past, indeed, there were always concerns about the Balkanization of America, especially in particular areas with massive immigration of people from all over the world. But we were able to deal with that. And whether or not it was even beginning to occur, that Balkanization, it was overwhelmed because we had this cyclical process. A cyclical phenomena of immigration and the assimilation process. It was, by the way, wanted by most of the people who came during that period of time. They wanted to become Americans, and indeed, even if they didn't want to, the system sort of forced them to because you're overwhelmed by it. But it has changed dramatically because of the geography, because of our proximity to the country contributing so many of folks here, and because of the strong cultural connections that exist and that naturally would be able to be retained much more easily than it was 100 years ago. This creates a problem when we don't try to encourage assimilation, when we tell people they shouldn't assimilate. There's nothing of value here. Why would anybody want to be part of this thing called the American experience? And I assure you, when, again, look at the parade, the May Day parades, and tell me that those folks want to be Americans. What they want is, what they're doing is, waving flags of other countries, demanding to be allowed to stay here and seek the benefits of the economic order, but not necessarily to disconnect from the country of origin. I wish it was happening. God knows, this debate would be far less rancorous. I'm not talking about Linda and myself. I mean, we get into much more difficult situations. I have certainly been in much more difficult situations where people are throwing rocks through the window on college campuses when I'm trying to speak. So it's a very emotional issue. It's a very controversial one. And I wish to God we could figure out a way to make it less so. And the way to do this, I think, is to reduce immigration until we can catch up with this, and to change, to the extent possible, this multiculturalist attitude in our schools. That's harder than doing the immigration side, by the way.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We are already over. I want to thank both of you. There's certainly much more to be said, and maybe we can have you both back at some point in the future.
You bet.
Certainly appreciate your time today, Linda Chavez and Tom Ten Credo. Thank you both very much. To the audience, I want to thank you as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful comments and questions. Reminder to check with our website for the next scheduled teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.